Good morning. My name is Bernie Buescher, Secretary of State, State of Colorado. Thank you for coming to the hearing which we have convened today on rulemaking under Amendment 54. I'm going to now introduce Deputy Secretary of State William A. Hobbs, and the Deputy Secretary will conduct this meeting, allowing me to take notes. And Bill, if you'd proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. My name is Bill Hobbs, Deputy Secretary of State. For the record, this is a formal rulemaking hearing. We are recording. We're also broadcasting on the Internet. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. The date is July 22, 2009. And the time is 9:32 a.m. Other people present here at the table with me, to my immediate left, is Maury Kanizer, Deputy Attorney General, who represents the Secretary of State's office. To my far left is Christy Hebert of the Secretary of State's office. To the right of Secretary Buescher is Hillary Rudy of the Secretary of State's office. And to the far right, Andrea Geiger, also of the Secretary of State's office. This rulemaking hearing concerns a notice of rulemaking that was originally issued on May 29, 2009. Initially, the rulemaking was scheduled to be the rulemaking hearing was scheduled to be heard on July 8th. But as you know, we continued the hearing to today, awaiting a written decision from Judge Catherine Lemon in the two cases that were filed concerning the constitutionality of Amendment 54. And then several days ago, Judge Lemon issued her ruling. And subsequently, I don't know if everyone saw it, we did issue a notice late yesterday inviting people to comment on some of the specific questions that relate to the litigation on Amendment 54. And I think that is probably on the table, those questions, so I won't repeat those. But certainly we're interested in knowing what effect Judge Lemon's decision has on the authority of the Secretary of State to go forward with rulemaking. Our primary purpose here is simply to take testimony on the proposed rules. A rule that defines sole source government contract. We'll take the comments under advisement, probably leave the rulemaking record open for a period of time. We'll perhaps decide that at the end of the day. I think we do have at least one or two written comments that we've received so far. Certainly welcome any written comments that we receive today and then up until we close the rulemaking record as well. With that, I'd like to turn to public testimony, and we have several people signed up. Anyone who wishes to testify, please do sign up on sign-up sheets that are on the table by the door. When you testify, please identify yourself for the record and who you represent. So with that, I'll turn to Mike Feely. Mr. Feely.
Good morning, Mr. Hobbs.
Morning.
Mr. Secretary, Mr. Kanizer, and members of the Secretary's office. My name is Mike Feely. I'm an attorney with the firm of Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck, and I'm here today on behalf of Public Service Company of Colorado, which does business under the name of Xcel Energy. The main purpose of my comments this morning are to address those questions that were contained in the notice issued late yesterday. But as you know, on behalf of Xcel Energy, we did submit comments to the proposed rule itself on July 6th, supporting the rule as it was drafted. I don't know if we'll touch on that if you have any questions. And earlier yesterday, I did submit some additional comments, which to a large degree addressed some of the questions that the that were set forth in the notice that was issued later that day. Let me go directly to the questions contained in the the notice of yesterday afternoon. The first question that was asked was whether the Secretary of State has jurisdiction and authority to conduct rulemaking relating to Amendment 54 in general and Section 16 in particular, and subsequently to adopt the proposed rule. I think that the answer to that question clearly is that yes, the Secretary does have that authority. There are a couple of threshold points that I'd address. Judge Lemon's order did not strike any portion of Amendment 54. It preliminarily enjoined the enforcement of Amendment 54. Amendment 54, now incorporated into Article 28 of the Colorado Constitution, remains with us and may remain with us for some period of time. The court, in a preliminary manner, simply enjoined the enforcement of it. Also, I think that there is it raises a question because the court specifically enjoined the enforcement of the entirety of Amendment 54 except Section 16 and the provision that the rule addresses, the proposed rule addresses, is not in Section 16. It now resides in Section 2, 14.4 of Article 28 of the Colorado Constitution. As to the jurisdiction and authority of the Secretary, I believe that jurisdiction is largely and almost conclusively established constitutionally. Article 28, Section 9.1b of the Colorado Constitution gives the Secretary of State authority to promulgate rules as may be necessary to administer and enforce any provision of Article 28. As I mentioned a moment ago, the section which the rule addresses is contained within Article 28, that's Section 2.14.4. I think that this clear constitutional authority was not obviated by either the court's decision on the preliminary injunction order or Amendment 54 itself. There is nothing that takes away the authority that the Secretary has to do the things that are necessary for the operation of Amendment 28. That constitutional authority remains and is unaffected. And I think that the answer to the first question is simply, yes, you have the Secretary has the authority to do so. One issue that I think raises some questions but does not overcome the specific constitutional authority is a provision at the very end of Section 16 which grants the Director of the Department of Personnel the authority to promulgate rules with respect to the accumulation and development of the database. I think that that's, frankly, a practical necessity of that database, but I don't think that that, again, overcomes or eliminates the Secretary's authority over the entirety of Article 28. I believe another basis for the Secretary's authority is statutory. Clearly, Amendment 54 is designed and was designed as an election law. It was placed in the election and campaign sections of the Colorado Constitution. Colorado Revised Statutes 1-1-107 subsection 2 authorizes the Secretary of State to promulgate rules necessary for the proper administration and enforcement of the election laws. Judge Lemon, in her very thoughtful and detailed analysis, looked at the and considered Section 16 and really determined that it was ancillary to the entire operation. She specifically said that by the language of Amendment 54 in Section 16, that section is designed only to, quote, aid in the enforcement of this measure. The court said it was not intended to have any life of its own. The primary purpose of Amendment 54 presented to the voters was set forth in the ballot title, and that clearly was to advise the voters that Amendment 54 dealt specifically with the change or some additions to the election laws of the state. And I think the statutory authority of the Secretary, in addition to the constitutional authority, is well established. I also think that from a practical perspective, the Secretary should not dismiss his own authority. This is an election law. The term sole source government contract, as it's written in Amendment 54, is designed to be utilized in the election law, albeit a preliminarily enjoined election law. I think that the Secretary of State's office is the place in Colorado state government where the expertise and the knowledge of the election law exists and is the best place for the administration and the efficient administration of the development of rules to take place. I do not think that the simple reference at the end of Section 16 eliminates any of the authority of the Secretary. And I think that it's, frankly, promulgating rules with respect to election law in Article 28 is the job of the Secretary of State, and I think the Secretary does it well. I think the Secretary's office does it well. And from a practical perspective, I think the public would be well served if the Secretary continued to provide that authority.
Mr. Feeling.
Yes, sir.
In your earlier comments, you drew a distinction between Judge Lemon's enjoining the enforcement of Amendment 54 with the comment that the judge did not strike Amendment 54. I guess I'm not familiar with that as a constitutional distinction. Could you explain that a little further?
Well, procedurally, first, the court's order is a preliminary injunction, and a preliminary injunction is in place until a full trial on the merits of the case, and that has not yet taken place. And I understand the court, the state noted that, and that is why the court's order, that was probably one of the basis of the court's consideration for entering only a preliminary injunction rather than a permanent injunction, which is what the plaintiffs ultimately seek in the case. So the arguments are not yet done. I personally hope that they are done, but they are not yet done, and there are still some options available to those who have to either defend or for those who support Amendment 54 as it's written. It can go to a full trial, a full hearing on the merits, or it could go to a preliminary injunction is an appealable order, and it could proceed up the appellate order. But there is no final determination or pronouncement by the Colorado Supreme Court that Amendment 54, either Section 15, all of Amendment 54, or some pieces of Amendment 54, is unconstitutional and may not be enforced. It is simply preliminarily enjoined at this point. That is, no one can enforce it right now until this the procedure continues. So yes. But the practical problem of that is that there are still questions arising out in the real world.
There certainly are questions out there. If we had a final order of the court entering a permanent injunction, would it still be your opinion that we have jurisdiction under the other arguments?
Of course, it would depend on the terms of the permanent order, but if it was fashioned such as this, I do believe so, because the court did not strike all of Amendment 54. It left Amendment 54, Section 16, alive in Article 28 of the Colorado Constitution. And I think your constitutional authority is
so it's the placing question. Of Section 16 in Article 28, which is the organic place that we find our authority?
Yes, constitutionally. That is where you are delegated authority. I also note that the definition of sole source contract isn't in Article 16. I think it's a question, and I had an interesting conversation with one of the attorneys yesterday. I think it's a question as to whether the court struck all of Amendment 54 except the specific language in 16, or do you still have to refer to the definitional sections in Section 2? So I think that right now, and if a permanent order was entered similar to the order that Judge Lemon entered on Friday, your jurisdiction is without question. The second question that was asked in the notice is whether the preliminary injunction does or should affect rulemaking proceedings or adoption of the proposed rule. To that, I would suggest the answer is no. The authority of the Secretary of State to issue rules with respect to Amendment 54 was not an issue before the court. The Secretary of State, while enjoined by the preliminary injunction, was not a party to the action. The specific authority of the Secretary of State was not anything that the court opined on. The Secretary of State has independent, as I mentioned in my earlier argument, has independent constitutional authority to address rulemaking under Article 28, and that was not challenged or considered or addressed by the court whatsoever. So I don't think that the preliminary injunction should affect the rulemaking, the normal process which the Secretary engages in. The final question is an interesting question, whether, as indicated by Judge Lemon, the interpretation made by the proposed rule concerning public utility contracts is precluded by examples of sole source government contracts included in the Blue Book. I might note first that the proposed rule addresses more than just utility contracts. It addresses Medicaid contracts very specifically. It does also address, in its general language, all contracts which are not generally competitively bid. And this, in an otherwise thoughtful and detailed opinion, this might be one of the areas with which I disagree with Judge Lemon's analysis. I would point out first that she reached no conclusions with respect to that, and I think that while she addressed her beliefs as to what the Blue Book provided, that is not a finding or conclusion of the court. The court dealt with this issue in several places in the order. The first was on page 16 of the order, paragraph 43 of the stipulated facts. And with due respect to Judge Lemon, I've had a chance to speak with counsel who were involved in the case. While this particular paragraph suggests that it sets forth stipulated facts, that's not entirely the case. On paragraph 43, beginning 6 lines from the bottom, the sentence starts, "A problem with the proposed rule is that it excludes from the operation of Amendment 54 one of the specific examples of sole source government contracts," and it addresses the Blue Book language from that point. In speaking with counsel, I have not had an opportunity to view the written findings, stipulated findings that were presented to the court, but in speaking with counsel for both the state and the plaintiffs in the action, I was advised that that section of paragraph 43 was not included in the stipulated facts. May I approach?
Sure.
I have a little sheet here that copied verbatim the language of the Blue Book that deals with the same subject that Judge Lemon dealt with. I'm sorry. I have just enough copies.
Thank you.
What I've handed to the panel is the exact language of the Blue Book in black and some statutory references in red. And I'd like to walk through this because, with due respect to Judge Lemon, I believe that while she has a reading, it's not the correct reading of the Blue Book language. And let me explain why I come to that conclusion. The Blue Book language, which appears on page 17, if you get it off the internet, I think it's page 26 if you actually have a hard copy of the Blue Book, in its summary and analysis, made available to the public, asked the question, how are state government contracts awarded? And it then continues, state law requires, with few exceptions, vendors for state contracts be selected through a competitive bidding process. That, in fact, is an accurate statement of the statute that appears at CRS 24-103-201. From that point in the Blue Book, it specifies exceptions to that general rule. The very next sentence says, separate rules govern small and emergency purchases. That also is a correct statement of statutory law, and the statutory sites are set forth right below that line. The next sentence, it says, the Blue Book says, in some cases, a state agency may determine that only one good or service can reasonably meet the agency's need, and only one vendor can provide the particular good or service. Again, the statutory site upon which this statement is based is set forth there. Then the court goes on to give, then the Blue Book goes on to give examples of circumstances when competitive bidding is not used, include cases, and the last one is when public utility service ought to be purchased. But from a practical perspective, if you look at those particular examples, for example, the second one, where a sole supplier's item is needed for trial use or testing, well, that's the type of situation where competitive bidding is not contemplated or required. I mean, if the state for some reason needs a distributor from Ford for a Ford vehicle, it's not going to ask for competitive bids from General Motors or Chrysler. So I believe that, well, I understand and I can see how the judge may have turned this particular analysis around. I respectfully disagree with her, and I think that the Blue Book advised the public specifically of those circumstances where competitive bidding is not appropriate. When you put that into the context of the stated purpose of Amendment 54, and I mean the purpose set forth in the amendment itself, the court notes that on page 20 of her order, where she says, the only governmental interest identified in Amendment 54 itself is a quote, presumption of impropriety between contributions to any campaign and sole source government contracts. The purpose of Amendment 54, whether you agree with its final language or not, is to prevent pay-to-play. It's to prevent favoritism when contracting in areas where competitive contracting is to take place by awarding it to a pay-to-play participant. And there are many circumstances where competitive bidding is not warranted, appropriate, practical, or in the case of public utilities, even legal. So I believe that the judge, Judge Lemon, I have a different reading of the Blue Book than Judge Lemon addressed, although she didn't conclude that. And I'll stop at that point. My earlier comments submitted to your office on July 6th deal with the substantive issues of the proposed rule. On behalf of my client, I just want to note that we are very supportive of the rules the proposed rule the Secretary issued. We think that the public would be well served by the clarification suggested in the proposed rules. We think it's very practical, and notwithstanding the preliminary injunction, which I hope ultimately is turned into a permanent injunction, because I think Amendment 54 is, with all due respect to the position Mr. Kneiser is presenting to the court, I think Amendment 54 is a very difficult, unworkable, and probably unnecessary in this political climate piece of constitutional language. I think that the public would be well served by the Secretary's clarification of the definition of sole source government contract. Could I answer any questions?
I have a couple. And thank you, Mr. Feeley, for the written comments and as well as responding to the specific questions. Much appreciated. You pointed out at the beginning that Article 28 has a general grant of rulemaking authority for the Secretary of State to promulgate rules with respect to the entire article. And in fact, it's mandatory. There's a shall that's attached to it that Secretary of State has to promulgate rules relating to that entire article, which includes Section 15 and Section 16. But wouldn't it be the case that as long as the enforcement of Amendment 54 is enjoined, except for Section 16, that even if the Secretary could promulgate a definition of sole source government contract, it wouldn't have any effect as long as the injunction is in effect, except with, of course, with respect to Section 16. So it would be kind of a useless act except with respect to Section 16. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's primarily a fair statement. However, the definition of sole source government contract appears in yet another section of Amendment 28. It's now in Section 2 in the definitional mm-hmm. section. I think that the definition of sole source government contract is also a necessarily defined term for the operation of the unenjoyed portion of Section 16. And in fact, the court, when it, on page 26, in the middle where the court, after applying a balancing test, determined not to include Section 16 in the injunction, did note, and I'm quoting here, on the one hand, the only overbreath it, that is Section 16, suffers from is the very broad definition of sole source government contract. So I believe that from, to answer your question directly, I think the Secretary's authority to promulgate rules clarifying a section of Article 28 that contains the definition is without question. That definition is necessary for the operation of Section 16. And in fact, the court noted that the definition probably needs some clarification. I do agree, however, that the court's order enjoins the enforcement, which includes the penalties. So Section 16 stands out there by itself right now with a direction for those parties who have a sole source government contract, however that might be defined, to compile and disclose and report a government contract survey. It requires the director of the Department of Personnel to assemble that into a database. And so that operation has to can only take place within the definition of sole source government contract, which I think, and I believe the court believes, needs some clarification. Did that get to your question?
It does, and it leads into you're leading into my second question. Since only Section 16 is enforceable now, and that section uses the term sole source government contract, and it may be overly broad, and it may be that somebody needs to issue a definition, the question then becomes, is it the Secretary of State or is it the Executive Director of the Department of Personnel Administration? And with respect to, you know, on the one hand, you've pointed out the general grant of rulemaking authority for Article 28, but then you've also pointed out for Section 16 alone, there's a specific grant of rulemaking authority for the Executive Director. And do you read those two, for purposes of Section 16, are you suggesting then that there's concurrent rulemaking authority for Section 16? Or, you know, what I'm wondering about is if you're just looking at Section 16, then the specific controls over the general and the executive director would have that rulemaking authority to promulgate the definition.
I tried to look. Since these questions just came up yesterday, I tried to take a look at some Colorado case law with respect to concurrent or coterminous jurisdiction of agencies and didn't find a whole lot. That's why I looked at it sort of from a practical perspective. While there's a specific delegation of authority to the Department of Personnel in Section 16, I do not believe that any language in Section 16, nor anything the court determined, nor anything I can find in Colorado law elsewhere, deprives the Secretary of State of the mandatory constitutional authority over matters arising under Article 28. So in a sense, I believe that there probably is, with respect to Section 16, coterminous or concurrent jurisdiction. Now, I think there's a practical consideration to be made as well, and I think that has to be taken, the practical considerations are to be taken into account by both of the departments in their exercise of the authority that they're given. And that is what I touched on briefly. That is that I believe the thrust of Amendment 54 is to deal with campaigns and elections. I think that notwithstanding the requirements and the contribution prohibitions and the enforcement having been enjoined, that it is still the sole source government contract taken as a whole has to be considered and defined in connection with the entirety of Amendment 54. I think that that's best done and traditionally done and constitutionally done by the Secretary's office. I do not think that the Secretary would be pleased, nor would the public be well served, if, for example, the Department of Personnel decided that it was going to clarify a definition contained in a different section of Article 28. I think that's not the Department of Personnel's expertise. I think that in terms of development of the database, that's exactly who should be developing the rules to administer the requirements of Section 16. But I don't think that they have the experience or the expertise to take a step back, look at it in the context of the election rules, look at it in the context of what Amendment 54 attempted to accomplish. I think that's within the authority of the Secretary of State. I may be corrected down the road somewhere, but I did spend a fair amount of time last night looking at this question of concurrent or coterminous jurisdiction and didn't find a lot on it. Didn't find much on it. There's actually one statute in Colorado under the Transportation Act that deals with coterminous jurisdiction and between the Department of Transportation and CDOT and that sort of thing. That's the only reference I found in Colorado law, which, by the way, acknowledge that coterminous representation does, in fact, exist on in that instance.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Mr. Feely, I'll admit that I was reading the judge's decision Monday night late, and in between thunderclaps and lightning flashes, I may have missed something.
We're always happy to have you on the front range. But
It's not clear to me the effect of the judge's order on the first sentence of Section 17. The first section, Section 1, says every sole source government contract by the state or any of its political subdivision shall incorporate Article 28, Section 15 into the contract. And in trying to think through what is the immediate driving force for our entering or adopting a rule, one of the things that has been mentioned in some of the written commentary is the challenges of putting this amendment into contracts for your client Excel with a government entity or for any of the others. What is your opinion about that first sentence? Is it in force or is it enjoined?
I believe that it would be enjoined. The court preliminarily enjoined all of Amendment 54 except Section 16. That language appears in the, as you mentioned, it's the first sentence in Section 17, and it is the probably the primary reason why questions have arisen out there in the real world about whether it is, you know, whether I am a sole source contractor, whether we are entering into a sole source government contract, and therefore whether we need to contractually include the provisions there. I agree. That's there. But I think that at this point in time, given the preliminary nature of the injunction, Secretary, you practiced in the private sector. What would your conservative advice to your client be? And you know, the question still arises, and I think it would be less than prudent for someone not to consider the inclusion of that language until this is fully and finally determined. And that's why I think that the questions still exist, and clarification from the Secretary, for as long as Amendment 54 remains on the books and possibly to be enforced down the road, a possibility I shudder at, Mr. Secretary, but as long as it's there, I think that that doubt exists, that parties entering contracts probably have to artfully draft their contractual languages. I think that it's been our experience, and I take my word for it, but in talking with city councils or city managers and negotiating franchise agreements, they're going to take the most conservative position possible, and they're going to insist that that language be placed into the franchise agreements that are necessarily, by law, sole source contracts. So I think that I hope that eventually got to the answer of your question, Mr. Secretary.
And I think that that's helpful. So it is your argument that even though that first sentence of Section 17 is enjoined, the practical result in the real world is that this language will be included in contracts with municipalities or other governmental agencies, and that is a burden that causes damage.
Yes,
harm.
And let, I think it's an even more open question than that, because only the enforcement of Amendment 54 was enjoined. Not the language, or it wasn't stricken or anything. It's the enforcement. So the language still exists, but the enforcement of the language has been enjoined.
And the insertion of this language into those contracts is a component of the enforcement of Amendment 54?
I think it's a practical concern of the parties to the agreement. I think that they, you know, there is language in our Colorado Constitution right now that says thou shalt put this in your sole source government contracts, however you define that. Now, no one is going to have the ability to enforce that, but what sort of contractual obligations arise as a result? And as I said, the conservative perspective would be, you know, we better do this until we get a final answer and a final word. So that's the confusion that I think the original proposed rule was designed to address, or that's part of the confusion. And I think the need to clarify that still exists out there, despite the fact that the enforcement of Amendment 54 has been enjoined on a preliminary basis.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Feely?
Thank you very much.
Richard Westfall.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary, Mr. Hobbs. My name is Richard Westfall. I work with the law firm of Hale Friesen. And while I have represented and advised a number of clients on Amendment 54, I'm appearing here today just on behalf of myself, and I'm going to limit my comments to specifically answering the three questions that were posed by the Secretary yesterday. I wanted to just help assist the Secretary in making a record on those points. And Mr. Feely did a very, very good job of covering the waterfront, and I don't in no way want to belabor this hearing anymore. So I will address each of the points in short order, again, just to make a record in support of these rules. First off, as I'd like to know, as a preliminary matter, as Mr. Kneiser knows, while I was working for Attorney General Norton, I helped oversee the Attorney General's exercise of authority in the rulemaking process. So I have some basis for opining in this area, and I thought it would be, given that background, I thought it would hopefully be helpful to the Secretary to at least, you know, go on the record to address these three particular questions. Question number one, whether the Secretary of State has the jurisdiction and authority to conduct rulemaking related to Amendment 54 in general and Section 16 in particular, and subsequently to adopt the proposed rule. I would join Mr. Feely's comments in saying, answering the question yes. I believe the statement of rulemaking authority that was set forth in your proposed statement of basis, purpose, and specific authority promulgated by the Secretary on May 29, 2009, remains in effect today, and that there's nothing that's happened either in the Judge Lemon's decision or the conduct of the case or the pendency of imminent, Colorado Supreme Court review of the case that in any way obviates or in any way undermines your rulemaking authority that's set forth in that basis, proposed statement of basis and purpose. With respect to the second question, whether the preliminary injunction issued by the court on July 17, 2009 does or should affect the rulemaking proceedings or the adoption of the proposed rule, I echo Mr. Feely's comments. It's only a preliminary injunction. It's who knows what the Colorado Supreme Court will or will not do. I think to the extent to which these rules provide additional clarity and certainty for the contracts that could be that would be implicated by the rules, that you're providing additional assurance to those parties, I think that clarity is certainly needed and important, and it's an important part of the overall fabric of the official response, if you will, both by the courts and by the Secretary, of addressing Amendment 54. And I think it provides an important piece of the puzzle, not just in, again, showing the official response and how Amendment 54 should be appropriately interpreted, but also I think it, in some sense, provides some additional guidance to the Colorado Supreme Court. And on that basis alone, I say not only, you know, again, echoing Mr. Feely's comments, should you in any way not be dissuaded by going forward with your rules as a result of the action, I think it's an important step in the overall process. With regards to the last question, then, whether, as indicated by Judge Lemon, the interpretation made by the proposed rule concerning public utility contracts is precluded by examples of sole source government contracts included in the Blue Book, I again join Mr. Feely's comments. I just don't think as I understand that this particular issue was not really teed up in the litigation. I certainly think Judge Lemon, let me take a step back. To the extent to which the Blue Book addresses this issue on utility contracts, I think at most from a proponent of Amendment 54's perspective, it's ambiguous. And I think the better reading of the Blue Book language is that, in fact, it's designed to show examples of when you would, number one, it's an exemption. It shows when you shouldn't be considering examples of where a competitive bidding process is not appropriate. Therefore, a soliciting of three bids is not appropriate. I see it as certainly an illustration of that point. In addition, I think it underscores the language here where on the third bullet of the Blue Book where it says where public utility services are to be purchased. If anything, what that language is doing is it's underscoring the vendor-vendee relationship, which gets to the heart of what you're talking about here, the scope of Amendment 54. And it's talking about a limited subset when a utility company is selling, for example, electricity to the Department of Personnel and Administration, you know, for running the state buildings, if you will. It's limiting its scope to that. I view it, if anything, it's an a fortiori type situation where certainly a utility franchise could not be contemplated. And I think that's a better reading of Amendment 54, the Amendment 54 Blue Book language. And again, I would respectfully disagree with paragraph 43 in Judge Lemon's decision for the reasons that were stated by Mr. Feely. So I wanted to just simply go on the record for myself in answering those three questions. Be happy to answer any questions you may have. Otherwise, I'll be happy to sit down and let the rest of the folks speak.
Any questions for Mr. Westfall? Guess not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Wiest.
Good morning, Mr. Hobbs, Mr. Secretary, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Jeff Wiest. I'm here as the Executive Director of the Colorado Cable Telecommunications Association. We're the trade association for the cable TV industry in the state of Colorado. Here today to support the proposed rules and to suggest some additional language to the rules defining sole source contracts under Amendment 54. We would suggest adding language, which I provided to you already, to specifically include a non-exclusive cable television franchise granted or renewed under the terms of the Federal Cable Act. Cable television companies must, under federal law, secure a franchise, which is a contract, from local governments to operate, to be in business. Those franchises, which by law, by federal law, are non-exclusive, give cable operators a permission to operate in the rights of way of that local government. Nearly all franchises require cable operators to pay the city up to 5% of their gross revenues. For reasons I'll review, it is clear, at least to us, that that cable TV franchises are not sole source contracts under either the letter or the spirit of Amendment 54. Nevertheless, some local governments have taken the position that Amendment 54 does apply to cable TV franchises. Given the extreme limitations on the First Amendment rights of political participation for any company deemed to be a sole source contractor under Amendment 54, we ask you to amend the proposed rules to specifically exempt non-exclusive cable TV franchises. Specifically, a cable TV franchises clearly are, to quote from the proposed rules, a contract for which there is no legal requirement or authority for a competitive bidding process. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The original grant of cable TV franchises by local governments, which took place largely back in the 1970s and 1980s, actually were very competitive. Many companies aggressively bid to secure franchises from local governments. These original franchises, though, lasted for terms ranging from 10 to 20 years, at which time they were renewed and have been renewed consistently. Most existing franchises in Colorado today have been renewed at least once. The position of the cities, I guess I should interject, is that the renewal has not been competitively bid. Therefore, that's what triggers the sole source contracting. In fact, the federal law, though, controls the renewal of cable TV franchises. A local government must, by federal law, renew a cable TV franchise unless one of four specific tests are met. And I won't belabor those tests. They all basically revolve around the ability or inability of the franchisee to comply with the terms of the contract. Therefore, no bidding, quote-unquote, is done during a cable franchise renewal because federal law, in fact, prohibits it. Maybe more importantly, the plain language of 54 makes clear that it was never intended to apply to cable franchises. Amendment 54 was sold to voters as a way to limit corruption in the acquisition of goods and services by a governmental entity. The Blue Book says that it addresses a situation where governmental entities purchase goods and services from private sector vendors. The plain and ordinary meaning of a sole source contract invariably refers to a contract for the purchase of goods or services by a governmental entity. Cable franchises, on the other hand, exist not for the purchase of goods and services, but to regulate the cable TV system and the government's own right-of-way, not to provide any good or service, as I said. To further illustrate this point, the flow of money in a cable franchise is the exact opposite of that contemplated by 54. Whereas the government pays a contractor in a sole source arrangement, the cable TV company actually pays the government under a franchise agreement. That payment represents many things, including the use of the government's right-of-way and compensation to the city for the expense of administering a cable regulatory regime. As I said before several times, cable franchises are by federal law non-exclusive. Any entity can apply for a cable franchise at any time, and federal law prohibits a city from unreasonably denying the grant of an additional franchise. There is no solicitation process involved, competitive or otherwise, because federal law doesn't permit, require, or contemplate it. I've included with my comments, I provided to you a memo from our outside counsel that analyzes this issue in more detail. So for the foregoing reasons, we respectfully ask you to adopt the proposed rules and to specifically include cable TV franchises in the list of items excluded from the definition of sole source government contracts under 54. Because I know you'll ask me, let me just say, I am not prepared or do not have specific comments on the questions you asked yesterday. Other than to say we generally endorse the comments by Mr. Feely.
Thank you, Mr. Wiest. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Gruskin.
Mr. Secretary, Mr. Hobbs, Mr. Kaiser, members of the staff, my name is Mark Gruskin. I'm an attorney with Isaacson Rosenbaum, PC. I also was counsel at the trial level in Dahlman versus Ritter. For that reason, and because I anticipate an appeal, there's going to be a limit upon what I feel comfortable telling you. But I do believe that it's important to make sure that the record includes certain references to the judge's decision that I believe answered the Secretary's questions. Question number one relates to the jurisdiction and authority. I would note that the paragraph number 44, stipulated factual finding, on page 16 of the decision, specific, and I quote, the defendants are Bill Ritter, the governor of Colorado, and Rich L. Gonzalez, the executive director of the Department of Personnel and Administration, who is responsible for implementing the state database that lists sole source contracts. Both are sued in their official capacities only. I think that the answer to question one is a rhetorical question, which is this. If the Secretary goes ahead and adopts any rule, I'm not speaking as to this rule right now, but any rule that governs the operation of Section 16, and Mr. Gonzalez, who, quote, is responsible for implementing the state database that lists sole source contracts, then passes under the agreed upon regulatory authority in his department a different rule, which rule trumps the other? Amendment 54 doesn't say. And without some clarity about what could happen in the instance of a conflict between two departments, it seems to me that there is no presumption that this Department of State Government has the capacity to dictate the operations, the extent, potentially the budgetary commitments, and the legal authority of another department of the state of Colorado. The second and third questions to me seem to be subsumed within one general rubric, which is whether or not the court's ruling affects or governs this process. Mr. Feely pointed out the issue in terms of paragraph 43 and asked the question whether or not that was a stipulated matter. I would just point out that on page 23 of the decision, Judge Lemon really could not have been more clear in the final complete paragraph, and she said, and I quote, it, referring to Amendment 54, defines sole source contract far more broadly than the normal meaning of that term, and in such a way that it subjects to its sweeping ban on campaign contributions those who have government contracts that are not appropriate for competitive bidding, and even those whose contracts could not be competitively bid. The state argued that the court could interpret Amendment 54 as not applying to contracts that cannot be competitively bid. The problem with this suggestion is that the Blue Book makes it clear that such contracts are intended to be covered by Amendment 54. It lists as examples of no-bid contracts cases, quote, where equipment, accessories, or replacement parts must be compatible, where a sole source, sole supplier's item is needed for trial use or testing, and where public utility services are to be purchased, end quote. The end of this paragraph reads, holders of contracts like this cannot make any campaign or party contributions, though they pose no risk of corrupt influence of public officials. I think the last reference is that the so-called pay-to-play rationale that may have been used and may have justified other statutes simply isn't applicable here. In addition, on pages 25 and 26, Judge Lemon left no question about the extent of the reach of this amendment as governed by her decision or by the limits of her ability, and I would suggest any other branch's ability, to redefine these terms. Quote, Amendment 54's scheme of harsh penalties and freewheeling enforcement mechanism appears designed to maximize its chilling effect on the exercise of free speech and association through political contributions by anyone even remotely connected to a government contractor. This is the opposite of what the First Amendment requires of it. Because these overbroad applications permeate the amendment, the entire amendment is unconstitutional on its face. She thereafter takes Section 16 out of that statement, but she continues to say, at oral argument, court explored with counsel for all parties the possibility of curing the constitutional infirmities of Amendment 54 by a narrowing judicial construction. However, a court has an obligation to avoid judicial legislation. She cites the United States versus National Treasury Employees Union at 513 U.S. 454 479. 1995, and the court is satisfied that narrowing Amendment 54 to a constitutional scope would require an impermissible, wholesale judicial rewrite. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Questions for Mr. Gruskin?
Yes, Mr. Gruskin, it's a fascinating argument, but I fret that that's what we are doing, or the Secretary's office is doing, in defining sole source contract in a limiting way. It's the exact same thing that the judge says that she found impermissible. Can you help me with that?
Well, I can only say this, that at trial, The issue of this rule was before the court. It was the position of plaintiffs that I represent that if the secretary could take out one group, it could also take out other groups because they don't, such as labor unions, that frankly don't have contracts that can be competitively bid. The nature of the ruling is that there is no limitation on the reach of this amendment, and that the court can't engage in that kind of limitation. I don't disagree with your interpretation or your linkage in terms of this office's power and the court's power, neither of which undermine the inherent constitutional authority delegated to the executive director of the Department of Personnel and Administration to provide certain sort of regulatory guidance for purposes of Section 16.
I think, well, I'm not quite sure how to ask this question, and it's the kind of question you might not want to answer anyway, but I'm trying to think ahead in that, given that right now the posture is simply an injunction on enforcement, I expect at some point, but correct me if I'm wrong, a final ruling would it potentially invalidate particular portions of Amendment 54, maybe all of it, maybe portions consistent with Judge Lemon's injunction. But it's conceivable, and this kind of goes back to the discussion the Secretary had with Mr. Feeley, it's possible that Section 16 would remain along with the requirement of Section 17 that contracts include certain language. So it may be, and I'm not quite sure how to ask this, but it may still be that beyond Section 16, there is a need for a definition. Now, Judge Lemon's feeling about the intent, or her expression about what the intent of the proponents was, to have the broad coverage to even contracts that may be more remote. Nevertheless, that there's no decision on that. There's no final decision on that. And so it seems like arguably the Secretary is faced with merely the enforcement is enjoined right now. At some point, there may or may not be a finding about the reach of Amendment 54. And as soon as the enforcement could be lifted, there is a need at that point for some definition that may be consistent with Judge Lemon's decision or comments or inconsistent, but why not go ahead and have a rule that right or wrong makes an interpretation in anticipation of a final ruling? Does that make sense? I don't know that I'm still asking it very well, but I'm sort of trying to look down the road and anticipate the possibility that there will be a final decision, and we don't know what it'll look like. But doesn't the Secretary have an obligation to go forward in anticipation of that day?
My wife often says to me, "Why do you borrow trouble?" And I try to tell her that it's because I trained as a lawyer and I can't help but think that way. But I think her admonition is probably well placed here. We don't have a final decision yet. I think it's fair to say that, for instance, had there been rulemaking after the district court decision in the Amendment 41 case on whatever issue, everyone would have been surprised to find out that it was a needless exercise in light of where the Supreme Court decided it needed to be. And so it seems to me that that is a hypothetical, but I'm not sure how you get around my rhetorical question, which is, can you possibly argue that the Secretary preempts the field here as to definitional sections that govern Section 16? Remember, Judge Lemon said that she enjoined the entire amendment. So as to the concerns raised by Mr. Feeley that this is lodged in amendment in Section 2 of Article 28 rather than Sections 15 or 17, Judge said she was enjoining the entire amendment with the exception of Section 16. So I don't know that that's really a concern. Yes, I would tell you that at this point, there is no legal authority to suggest that a limiting definition is warranted or authorized. I understand that the sheer overbreadth, and one could argue the intentional drafting of this measure to apply in the way that Judge Lemon agreed that it applies is not something that has been finally resolved. But neither does that allow, in my view, any sort of restrictions on Amendment 54 that are more comfortable for those who are affected by it. I get that. I understand the quandary that companies like Mr. Feely's client are in. This was a problematic amendment from the word go, but this process, given the Department of Personnel's authority and the judge's clear ruling, can't relieve that discomfort.
Thank you.
Mr. Gruskin, these arguments are very subtle. I mean, all of the arguments we're talking about are very subtle. Give me, sitting in this chair for the first time in this, kind of an appreciation for what an appellate judge has to probably deal with every day. I think I hear you saying that we do not have the authority, kind of consistent with the judge's ruminations about whether she can interpret this in a way to make it constitutional. And in that context, her comment, her addition to paragraph 43 is read almost exactly the opposite way that the other folks interpreted. You're saying that she says, this is so bad that the amendment, that the authors of Amendment 54 could have chosen a way to limit it, but they did not do so. And she's not going to. That's kind of looking at this completely differently than the folks that commented earlier. Are you suggesting that our rulemaking would improve the constitutional nature of Amendment 54?
I don't want to leave any impressions that the answer to your question is yes, but I don't feel comfortable in a matter that's going to the appellate courts weighing in. But I will tell you this, that at the district court level, Mr. Feely's concerns about utilities weren't raised, as you pointed out, because they weren't there. But Mr. Kneiser in more than able representation of the state's interests here, crafted a series of potential narrowing constructions for the court to consider. The court found that because of what the proponents did and who the proponents were aiming at and the way they did it, that none of those narrowing constructions could be superimposed on Amendment 54 by the court. And that was obviously the position taken by the Dahlman plaintiffs, too.
Given that the appellate courts may not look at this until after the 2010 election, and that uncertainty about these issues that are in our proposed rule, isn't there clear harm pending the Supreme Court's decision that could impact the next election?
I'm not in a position to give you an opinion on that. I haven't heard any testimony about any clear harm. Believe me, there was, prior to June 23rd, there was plenty of harm, incipient and otherwise. And the judge's decision addressed that in the context in which it was presented to her, which were campaign contributions by sole source government contractors. Part of her analysis was that the harm was unavoidable because of the way this thing was crafted. If she couldn't avoid it or find a narrowing construction that would, I guess the question for this office is, what is the harm? Does this office have the authority to address it? And is that, as your questions point out, is your result governed by the one judicial decision that we've got? The one judicial decision, oh, by the way, that was brought here in the Denver District Court, to which this office, because it is lodged here, is subject. This isn't a district court decision that was brought over in Mesa County or in Pueblo County because there was a fact situation that prompted itself there. The Denver District Court is the court that, in as a matter of first impression, directs the operations or the interpretations that apply to this office as well. So this is more than an advisory opinion, I would argue.
We're not a party to this litigation.
No, but the state of but Governor Ritter, as the embodiment of the state of Colorado, is the defendant. The courts consider that the naming of the governor is not the naming of him in a personal way or just his office, but as the embodiment of the state. Therefore, I don't think that the secretary's office, because it was not named, has immunity from this decision. I don't think you're seeking that immunity at all. But it was not incumbent upon the plaintiffs to name the secretary's office because, frankly, at the time at which we filed the complaint, the secretary had no role in Amendment 54. You hadn't adopted rules, unlike the Department of Personnel and Administration, which it had adopted on January 1st, 2009, a technical guidance that directed public entities and government contractors how to act and what limitations there were. That's why Mr. Gonzalez was sued.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Griskin. Next on the sign-up sheet is Doug Friednash. Good morning.
Good morning. Always good to follow Mr. Griskin. My name is Doug Friednash. I work at the law firm at Greenberg Traurig. I was plaintiff's counsel for the Ritchie plaintiffs along with Gene Dabosky. I wanted to comment in reference to Secretary Buescher's solicitation of comments on three specific issues. We believe Amendment 54's plain language, coupled with Judge Lemon's decision, and the Blue Book itself conclusively resolve all these issues. In November 2008, Colorado voters narrowly passed Amendment 54. On July 17th this year, District Court Judge Lemon found that the plaintiffs in Dahlman v. Ritter and Ritchie v. Ritter met their burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that Amendment 54's campaign finance restrictions are unconstitutional on its face and enjoin the enforcement of Amendment 54 except for Section 16. The trial court reasoned that Amendment 54 violates the rights of free speech and association. Judge Lemon further reasoned that Amendment 54 does not allow those subject to it to assess the burden on their constitutional rights and make informed decisions before acting. Therefore, she found the amendment was unconstitutionally vague. Judge Lemon refused to rewrite Amendment 54 in a narrowing way to make it constitutional. Quote, because these overbroad applications permeate the amendment, the entire amendment is unconstitutional on its face. And she specifically said the court has an obligation to avoid judicial legislation. Accordingly, Judge Lemon found that its provisions concerning contributions to ballot issues, the ban on contributions to candidates, political parties, and other entities were unconstitutional. The plaintiffs in this case didn't challenge Section 16. The only surviving section of Amendment 54 was Section 16, which requires the executive director of the Department of Personnel to promptly publish and maintain a summary of each sole source government contract that's issued. Amendment 54 in Section 16 specifically provides, quote, the executive director of the Department of Personnel is hereby given authority to promulgate rules to facilitate this section, unquote. Department of Personnel, as Mr. Griskin pointed out, has already acted in this area. They've published rules, they've done updates on these, they've issued technical assessments, and have acted within their province to implement this section. In reference to a question Mr. Hobbs asked earlier, I think the specific does take control over the general. And I think there are questions that could arise if these issues, if two different departments were to act. Amendment 54's plain language provides that to the extent the rules could even be promulgated, the executive director of the Department of Personnel has exclusive authority over this such revisions. Section 16 has no relationship to the campaign and political finance laws of Colorado and otherwise not within the province of the Colorado Secretary of State's office. In other words, those provisions that have been found to be enjoined were the campaign and finance provisions of Amendment 54. Further, I believe that putting such proposed revisions through the Colorado Secretary of State's office creates the impression that the state is attempting to revive election and campaign applications. Finally, the court in several instances addressed the problems with the proposed rulemaking and the significance of the Blue Book in recognizing that such exceptions cannot be carved out here. Specifically, if you look at page 16 of the ruling, paragraph 43, some of this language, the first portion of this came from stipulated facts, but the court makes it clear their findings of facts were limited to the testimony, exhibits, and other things that came into the court. This was the end of this, which I'll read in a second, came directly from the court. This was not part of a stipulated fact. The court considered the May 29th Secretary of State Bernie Busher's proposed rule regarding Amendment 54. The court said, a problem with the proposed rule is that it excludes from the operation of Amendment 54 one of the specific examples of sole source government contracts included in the public, in the Blue Book, public utility contracts. While it might have been reasonable for the authors of Amendment 54 to limit its contracts for which a competitive bidding process would be appropriate, or at least possible, the Blue Book example precludes such an interpretation. The court's already specifically addressed this issue. Now, at the end of the day, you know, there are a lot of us that would like to see things that would have been carved out from Amendment 54. I think by starting to carve out such things, you're opening the floodgates for continuous requests for interpretation as to what falls within the purview. Reading the judge's decision, the issue of what is a sole source government contract was not vague, and it was not part of what was the overbreadth application. The court found, quite simply, that this applies to all no-bid contracts that don't at least solicit three bids. The court didn't find this term to be vague, and we believe that at this point, this exercise, you know, opens the floodgates to all kinds of potential legal issues for the Secretary of State's office, for the state as well. I do think, you know, the state was, as Mr. Gruskin pointed out, sued because you have to sue Bill Ritter as the executive of the state. He represents the state. You have to file these cases in Denver District Court, and it does apply to the state of Colorado. And I do believe, as a result of that, this is indeed not an advisory opinion. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Gruskin, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Friednesh. This amendment is placed in Article 28, and Section 9 of Article 28 requires the Secretary of State to promulgate such rules as may be necessary to administer and enforce any provisions of this article. It doesn't just say this section, it says of the entire article. Doesn't that require us to make rules on this subject?
Well, there's several levels to answer the question. First, I think the state, I think the court has spoken specifically on this issue and said it can't be interpreted this way. It's an erroneous interpretation. That's a finding.
But that's a different question. Okay, but that's a question of whether or not the rule is right. It's not a, that doesn't respond to whether or not we have the authority or the requirement to make a rule.
Well, this is a constitutional amendment, and in this constitutional amendment, if you were dealing with just Section 15 or 17, it'd be an easier answer. But Section 16 put exclusive authority specified through a constitutional amendment that I think takes precedence here. and says the Department of Personnel has authority to promulgate these rules.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Friedensch.
Thank you.
Harry Hershey.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Hershey. I'm legal counsel to the Colorado Medical Society. With me here today is Chet Seward. He's the director of the Physician Disaster Preparedness Initiative and senior director in the Division of Healthcare Policy at the Colorado Medical Society. The Medical Society submitted written comments to the Secretary of State prior to the written decision of Judge Lemon and prior to issuance of your amended notice for today's rulemaking hearing yesterday. So my comments will differ a little from the written comments that were submitted by the Medical Society. Additionally, I'm not here to talk about questions one or three because the speakers before me are much more qualified to do so, and I defer to their comments on that. What the Medical Society is here to talk about is the Disaster Preparedness Initiative and its importance to the state and its citizens in the event of a disaster. Chet, do you want to give them the fact sheet? May Mr. Seward approach?
Yes.
And we've prepared a fact sheet for you just about the work that is part of the Disaster Preparedness Initiative. And as you'll note from our comments, the Medical Society entered a contract for this initiative in 2006, December 2006. And it's been part of an ongoing effort for the Medical Society to work with the state and other local, regional, and statewide partnerships and coalitions to make sure that there is a coordinated and effective response from healthcare providers in the event of a disaster. The contract is over $100,000. However, it is funded exclusively by federal funding dollars. And there is some concern as to whether or not this contract would qualify as a sole source contract under Amendment 54. Because of the ambiguity of the broad language of Amendment 54, the Medical Society seeks clarity that a disaster preparedness contract with a statewide agency that is not available to be publicly bid because there are very few organizations, there is no organization like the Colorado Medical Society. There is a society of osteopaths, but it's much smaller. When there is nobody else to do this work, it raises a concern as to whether or not this falls under Amendment 54. In light of the recent court events, we don't take a position as to whether this office, this department should make rules, whether the Director of Personnel should make rules. All we're seeking is some clarity that if there is not a permanent injunction, that our organization be assured that it can continue its efforts to help prepare the citizens of Colorado in the event of a disaster without having to give up their First Amendment rights to participate in political processes. And I'll answer any questions you have.
Questions for Ms. Hershey? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who has not signed up would like to testify? Ms. Madsen. I'm sorry. I thought you were not going to testify. That's why I didn't call on you. So.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, Mr. Hobbs, Mr. Kneiser. Originally, I was not going to make any comments, but this is Shane Madsen from the law firm of Jackson Kelly. I represent a number of clients who are impacted by 54, not the least of which are the myriad of special districts that exist in this state to provide a variety of infrastructure needs. But I must rise in support of Mr. Feely's position. I guess we'll call it the Feely interpretation. I think it's absolutely correct. And I did want to leave, Mr. Secretary, you with one observation. As I was listening to all the speakers, I think the line needs to be drawn between the restraints on the judiciary to engage in lawmaking which is the philosophy that I think was reflected in Judge Lemon's opinion, as opposed to your broad authority under Amendment 28, in fact, your mandate to engage in rulemaking. And I think you have the ability to make law within the purview of Amendment 28, and the judiciary doesn't. And I think that's one of the dilemmas that Judge Lemon was wrestling with. You do have that mandate. And then when you look at the specifics of 54, it's permissive in terms of the Department of Personnel and Administration to engage in rulemaking, and they may only engage in rulemaking to facilitate. I don't see the word interpret in their delegation of authority to engage in rulemaking. I think it is very important for your office to consider these proposed rules. You might want to solicit additional comments from folks who are impacted. But I think that your obligation is clear under Amendment 28. I think that the first sentence of Section 2 that requires this language to be put into contracts, I mean, put yourself in the position of a special district anticipating issuing bonds and those very conservative bond attorneys and what they're going to require in terms of the various contracts. And that's just one of those bread and butter issues that are out there. They're quite important to the people who have to implement and engage in compliance with Amendment 54. And as the Medical Society pointed out, and I do have clients who are in the same position, there are a number of contracts that the state enters into which are federally funded. They're in no way the provision of goods and services that are contemplated by 54. They're entirely different animals, and they should not be swept in to 54. So those are my comments. I would be pleased to answer any questions and pleased to submit any follow-up comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I do want to give an opportunity to anybody who's already testified in light of other comments that were made. If anybody has any brief comments to make, you're welcome to come forward. Mr. Feely.
Thank you. I want to address a couple of points of Mr. Griskin and Mr. Friednash. Really, Mattson almost stole my thunder, but the first point that Mr. Griskin made was painting a scenario of two agencies working at cross purposes and one agency affecting the budget and the rules and the authority and the administration of another. And frankly, I think that the likelihood of that is so remote as to be non-existent. Not only would neither the Secretary's office nor the Department of Personnel's office attempt to interfere with one another's business, there are numerous safeguards that are built into our rulemaking process, including the rule review process, so that's not going to be I don't believe that's a realistic concern. The second thing, it also goes towards the question that was Mr. Friednash addressed with regard to the exclusive jurisdiction for Section 16 given to the Department of Personnel. While I can understand Mr. Friednash's position on that, I don't believe that there's any law that suggests that there is exclusive jurisdiction, nor is there anything, as I mentioned earlier, that precludes the very specific grant of authority to the Secretary of State that is overcome by anything in Amendment 54 or the Court's decision. But Mr. Griskin, in response to the Secretary's question, said one thing that I found extremely interesting, and that was that during the course of the litigation, the plaintiffs did not want to give the court the opportunity, or did not want to provide the court with either the opportunity or give the court the thought that they could exclude some parties from the operation of Amendment 54 and not exclude other parties. And I think that is a very legitimate position that the plaintiffs took in the case. It's a tactical decision. It is the decision that I'm sure I would have taken, and I'm sure Mr. Kneiser probably had to resist, but that's a tactical decision to be dealt with by the court and the court performing its responsibilities. That's not something that has to be taken into consideration by the Secretary when exercising the constitutional grant of authority over rulemaking so that there can be an efficient administration of the rules that are based upon the provisions of Article 28. I think that is what happens in the court and the tactical decisions which drive a lot of the concern I heard is not anything that should affect the Secretary of State in the discharge of his duties.
Mr. Feeley, if I could ask just one follow-up question. Although I'm wondering if you could just elaborate a little bit on this suggestion that given that the governor was a defendant as the governor and this was a decision of the Denver District Court, is the Secretary of State not bound, fully bound by this decision at the present?
I agree with Mr. Friednash and Mr. Gruskin on that point. I think that when you sue the state, venue is necessarily in Denver District Court. I think that's a fairly common rule. I think that the governor is sued in his capacity as a representative of the state. I think that the state as a whole, including the Secretary, is preliminarily enjoined from the enforcement of Amendment 54. I do think that that's a different question than the one that's presented and the one that the Secretary considered when he issued his notice of proposed rulemaking and wrote the proposed rule. Yes, I do not think the Secretary of State would have any authority, would be enjoined from attempting to exercise any provision. I think that's clear, and it's a separate question than trying to effectively administer the provisions of Amendment of Article 28.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Gruskin.
Mark Gruskin for the Donlan plaintiffs. I'm sure Mr. Feeley didn't mean what he said, but let me just make clear. The position that was taken during litigation was not a matter of tactics. It was something that the courts imposed, which is a requirement that there be a use of the plain language of the amendment and that it be interpreted based upon the plain language. That's what the judge relied upon. Where words were unclear to her, she turned to the blue book, which is what rules of judicial construction also require. There were no tactics in this litigation. This was a matter of looking at the express language that the proponents, for whatever reason, chose, and applying that wording. And I just wanted to clarify the record so that there was no suggestion that somehow ethically I'm willing to portray something to the court that I wouldn't portray to the executive branch of state government. Our position is the same. This was written, it was written with overbroad, intentionally, I would argue, overbroad language, and I say that because there was nothing that was presented at trial in terms of even the proponents in their own amicus brief to suggest otherwise. This was all about squelching certain kinds of speech, and as the judge pointed out, some of its definitions, a different one, this one, the definition of immediate family, was actually Orwellian. Your problem isn't to figure out 1984. Your problem is simply to figure out what you can do vis-a-vis the Department of Personnel and Administration. And neither our position in court nor our position here today is a reflection of tactics.
Thank you, Mr. Gruskin. I certainly did not take Mr. Feeley's comments in any way challenging the ethical conduct of the trial.
And as I said, I don't think they were intended that way, but someone else reading this record, they can look at the words that were used, could reflect otherwise. Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Feeley.
Let me also clarify. There was no suggestion on my part of unethical tactics. In fact, if Mr. Gruskin felt that way or feels record needs to be corrected, let me do that and let me apologize. If counsel did not use tactics in the litigation, it might be the first case in the history of jurisprudence where counsel did not use tactics, and it was met in that context too. There's no imputation or suggestion that the tactics were inappropriate. I can understand exactly why, because without elaborating on it again, I just don't want to leave the record unclear for a moment, because it shouldn't be.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify this morning? If not, then we'll close the hearing. We can leave the rulemaking record open for written comments. And I guess I'll just ask, I would think at least by, we could leave the record open at least to the end of the week. Does that make sense? So we'll accept written comments, additional written comments, through close of business Friday the 24th. July 24th. So with that, we'll conclude the hearing. The time is 11:03 a.m. Thank you all for coming.